Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this concluding episode of his 4-part History of the Caribbean, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about how the nations of the Caribbean have adapted to modern times.
Considering the Caribbean in the 20th century, there are a number of obvious themes that come to the fore. In particular, looking at it from the perspective of the end of the century, it's the Cuban issue, both the seizure of power by Fidel Castro and the implementation of a communist regime, and also more specifically the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, that engages enormous attention. I think it's fair to say that at the outset or the early decades of the century, that would have seemed a rather unlikely outcome. There had been left-wing movements, particularly the Sandinistas in Nicaragua in the late 1920s, the beginning of the 1930s, but radicalism had been contained in the early 20th century. And in many senses, the Caribbean was part of an American informal empire combined with the remains of the formal empires of Britain and France and the Dutch. Now, as far as the informal empire of the United States was concerned, that represented a considerable continuity with the situation in the late 19th century, which we discussed in the previous episode. America had driven Spain from Cuba in 1898, and although Cuba became independent, unlike the Philippines, from which the Spaniards had also been driven, nevertheless, the new government, the new political system, the new economy in Cuba was very much dependent on the United States. The United States continued to claim the right to intervene in Cuban affairs. And indeed, the rather fire sale of Spanish assets at the end of the 19th century ensured that a lot of the Cuban economy was bought relatively cheaply by the Americans. The Americans also were well entrenched in the economies on the mainland of Central and South America, whether it was a question of the production of oil or the question of the production of bananas or of other products. And American interests in the Caribbean were further fostered in the first two decades of the 20th century, first by the creation of the independent state of Panama out of Colombia, a creation which very much owed a lot to American intervention, and secondly by the American building through the Panama Canal Zone, which it obtained, control over which it obtained from the new government, of the Panama Canal, which provided America with the capacity to have readily to be a two-ocean maritime power. And the Caribbean was then even more clearly within the military orbit of the United States. It had bases, including on the continental mainland, but also, for example, Guantanamo Bay, in Cuba. It had bases in the Canal Zone. And in 1917, in order largely to thwart what it was feared would be possible German influence, but also in order to enhance American control, the Americans bought the Danish Virgin Islands and turned those into the American Virgin Islands. So America was the dominant power. And this was in a way encouraged by the extent that there was no real dynamo behind the British, French, or Dutch imperial presence in the Caribbean. Britain and France expanded their empire considerably in the early decades of the 20th century, in part through territorial gains at the expense of the German and Turkish empires, but there were no German colonies in the Caribbean thus to seek. And in part also by expansion at the expense of non-Western powers. But again, there was no opportunity, nor did the British or the French or the Dutch seek expansion in that fashion. So there was a degree of quiescence in the British colonies. They were essentially run by white settlers in cooperation with the local agencies of the imperial government. The process was possibly most under the control of the white settlers in the British colonies. I think it's fair to say that in the French colonies, Guadeloupe and Martinique principally, there was a bit more dirigisme from Paris. But in no case can one really point to anything of enormous significance going on, whether that significance is assessed in terms of social development, economic use of the territories, or political activity. There was a certain degree in some of the colonies of disquiet about some aspects of the imperial link, but there was nothing that compared with the problems that the British and French empires encountered in the case of the British, for example, after World War I in Ireland or in Iraq or in Egypt, in the case of the French in Syria. There was no equivalent to that in the Caribbean. So I think it's fair to say those were essentially a quiescent area. In World War II, American presence was further enhanced. In part, this was because of American anxiety about the failings and failure of the British and French and Dutch imperial systems, and the concern that this would lead the German Navy to pursue a Weltpolitik, as indeed it would have liked to have done, of power projection into the Western Hemisphere, and the need accordingly to try and ensure that these territories were kept out of German hands. Now, this was a, as far as the French colonies were concerned and the Dutch colonies were concerned, this was a goal shared by the British. And between them, the British, the Canadians, and the Americans, just as in the Northern Atlantic, they thwarted German interest in taking over Iceland and Greenland from Denmark. So in the Caribbean, they put pressure on Martinique and Guadeloupe in particular to not be favourable to Germany. Although there was, this was more by way of blockade, it wasn't the equivalent to military interventions that were to be seen unsuccessfully with the British at Dakar in 1914, more successfully with the British in Lebanon and Syria, and then in Madagascar, and then with the British and the Americans in Morocco and Algeria, and eventually Tunisia. So it wasn't that there was significant fighting, other than fighting at sea. The German submarines operated in the Caribbean, particularly when the United States came into the war in December 1941. The Germans identified oil shipments, particularly from Venezuela to America and also along the American coastal waters, as a key strategic weakness or vulnerability of the United States, and one that they tried to exploit. Already by that stage, the Americans had taken out leases on British naval bases, principally in the Caribbean, though also further north, for example, in Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, in order to, well, in return for the provision of destroyers to the British, but also again in order to try and cement the Caribbean within the American system. So American warships were based in places like St. Lucia, Barbados, Antigua, and so on. America goes into the war in December 1941. The influence of the United States in its informal Latin American empire is such that the majority of Central American, South American, and independent Caribbean countries follow suit, not always at once, but fairly swiftly. In military terms, they don't do an enormous amount. The two most important are Brazil, which provides a significant amount of ground troops, particularly in the Italy campaign, and Mexico, which provides a smaller amount of force. Compared to that, Haiti or the Dominican Republic, for example, are not crucial players, but they are important in the sense that they become even more clearly economically switched in the American, providing raw materials for American consumers, American industry, and on top of that, providing bases for both American air power and American warships for use against German submarines, and also in order to help in the air bridge, a number of air bridges, but in the air bridge across to Brazil and from there to West Africa, through which aircraft were moved in support, eventually to support the British in the Middle East. So the war ends with American power more in the ascendant, if it can be thought of, than at any stage hitherto in the history of the Caribbean. And initially, after 1945, that situation continues. A number of strong men, if you like to use that term, autocrats, dictators, whatever term you wish to use, in places like Haiti and the Dominican Republic and Nicaragua, looked to the Americans and were actively allied with them. The American economy benefited from pretty well clear-cut opportunities for investment and economic activity. And in some cases, this was due not just, this is the illegal economy, as is the extensive mafia investment in Cuba. And also on top of that, the Caribbean becomes an area in which increased numbers of American tourists go for holiday, either going to resorts or cruising. So it's all part and parcel of a greater American world. Insofar as living standards are concerned, they're not particularly high. These are third world economies, but there is a development of a significant class in Cuba, and as well, of course, as the existing relatively large middle classes in Venezuela and Mexico. And it's also worth, as it were, turning the question on its head by pointing out that in many of the southern states of the United States, economic and social circumstances and political control was not necessarily a million miles different in some respects from what was going on in the Caribbean. And I think it's fair to say that New Orleans, for example, was a Caribbean city as much as Havana was. One was in the United States formally, the other was not, but there are significant similarities between them. Now, it would be mistaken to say that this was all abruptly changed by Fidel Castro. That would be ridiculous. There were a whole host of factors, some of them contingent. Castro, in part, was lucky that he was the of the rebels against the Batista regime in Cuba. He was the one that survived, whereas there had been other attempts to overthrow Batista that had been less successful and that might have taken Cuba in a democratic direction, as opposed to the authoritarian Batista and the authoritarian Castro, both of whom were dictators and both of whom were quite brutal. Castro more brutal probably than Batista. Possibly more significant, though we can revert to Cuba in a second, possibly more significant was actually the impact in the Caribbean of the more general process of decolonization, which wasn't initiated in the Caribbean, but which obviously affected the Caribbean. I say wasn't initiated. I'm not thinking of the Haiti in the 1790s. I'm thinking in more in the 20th century terms. Now, as far as decolonization was concerned, this was not a question of the French colonies, which remained part of metropolitan France as they are to this day, nor indeed of the Dutch counterparts. But what it was the case was of the British colonies, the vast majority of which moved to independence in the 60s and 1970s. There was not an equivalent to the violence or disruption seen in some British colonies, whether one's thinking of Cyprus or Malaya, very differently, instead of which the process was largely peaceful. The British were willing to concede independence. Initially in the 50s, the British position had been that only large territories were likely to have the ability to be viable as independent powers. The small territories, this should not be the case. Independence for Cyprus rather undermined that position. But nevertheless, the British in the Caribbean, as they tried to do in Southeast Asia with Malaysia, as they tried to do in East Africa and in Central Africa, preferred for the Caribbean the idea of a confederal state, with essentially Britain being a powerful ally, presumably retaining military rights and opportunities, but essentially being a sponsor power of this kind of harmony between the states, independent states. Well, it didn't work. There were tensions, notably between Jamaica and Trinidad, which were the two most economically significant of the British colonies. And the idea of a joint rule collapsed, although there remained a degree of cooperation between the states, which was not simply a matter of the Commonwealth. For example, when the Americans invaded Grenada in 1983, they did so in concert with the cooperative forces of a number of the ex-British Caribbean colonies. Anyway, this is possibly more significant in the long term for the Caribbean because it helped to ensure that the balance across much of the Caribbean swung towards states that were independent and also increased dramatically the numbers of those which were democracies. So whereas in Cuba and in Haiti and in the Dominican Republic, democracy did not feature, and since has proved very limited in its consequences and impact, the situation was very different in the British colonies, which created a particular political culture that is worthy of note. Other than that, though, these new colonies found it quite hard to establish the economies that would provide the living standards which a lot of their public needed. And this was not helped by, again, general moves, the movement away from the land, which produced very low profit towards towns, particularly shanty towns where employment was limited. The fact that individual countries had too small a domestic market to make manufacturing tremendously viable. The extent to which there were some extractive industries, oil from Trinidad, for example, but many of the countries did not produce either very much of value in trading terms or very much of value that also led to significant employment. And the result of this was a degree of continuation in the decades of independence of the movement away from the colonies, ex-colonies, to seek work elsewhere. So, for example, the Panama Canal had drawn heavily on the British West Indies for labour, much of which had not been well looked after, and there had been high death rates, yellow fever, but large numbers of people from Barbados. Within the post 1950, post 1960 world, you've got significant numbers of British Caribbean people, particularly from Jamaica, the largest of the British islands, moving to Britain, just as you've got large numbers moving from Puerto Rico, which remained part of the American system, did not gain independence despite there being an independence movement. Large numbers of those moved to moved to New York in particular and America in general. And in the case of Cuba, where obviously a lot of the people that moved to the United States, particularly Miami, but more generally, were political refugees from the autocracy of Cuba, I think it's fair to say there was also a degree of seeking economic opportunity. And even if Castro hadn't been there, I think there would have been a significant movement. So one of the problems in the Caribbean was birth rates and population size, providing a demand for opportunity that could not be met within the local economies. And that could lead to a degree of volatility. It could be seen in some places as encouraging recruitment into the drug trade. It certainly provided a large number of relatively cheap laborers for the tourist industry. In the case of Cuba, it provided the large numbers of troops which Castro sent to wars elsewhere, particularly in Angola, but also, for example, the Ogaden War between Somalia and Ethiopia. So labor was a significant export from the region. Now, it would be totally and utterly wrong to see that as some sort of equivalent or response to the previous centuries of slavery, because in the case of slavery, there had been no consent. And the only one of what we've just been talking about, which approximated to that, was the Cuban control over its labor force, which in effect was a slave labor force of an autocratic state. But there was nothing similar to that in the other Caribbean countries. And I think it's fair to say that, though, that what is interesting are these labor flows. There was very little labor flow back to Africa. Of course, the actual links in terms of social, economic and political links were modest. The amount of economic opportunity in West Africa was very modest. There were no language links or anything like that. But it is certainly interesting to see the contrast in labor flows. I think if we are looking to sort of sum up the history of the Caribbean in the next few minutes and where we are at the present day, what I would say is it's an area with people who have a great degree of potential, but have often been underperformed by either the external political agencies which control them, or by the nature of the politics and government, self-government within the region itself. I think both of those are problematic. On the other hand, there are a lot of positives to consider. There is a considerable degree of social cohesion provided through matrilineal family networks, through a kind of evangelical Christianity, through a desire for social cohesion, which I think is important. On the other hand, the impact of the COVID pandemic on the economy has been fierce, particularly on tourism, but actually more generally. And it is by no means clear how easily the societies of the Caribbean will face the pressures of the next decade, not least because the opportunities to be gained through exporting, as it were, male labor in particular, some female labor, but male labor in particular to other economies will be lessened as those economies themselves encounter significant problems. So I think those elements need to be considered. There are other elements as well. There are several failed states. The failed states are of different kinds. The most spectacular are Haiti and Venezuela, both of which have suffered from extraordinarily poor government in recent decades. And in the case of Venezuela, despite ample resources available from oil exploitation. Nevertheless, it is in fact a failed state with a vicious public politics and a autocratic regime. And looking in that to support from Cuba and also from Russia, and it one can wonder whether in fact in the growing international competition of a new Cold War, apparently a new Cold War, whether both Russia and China will, as it were, try and fish in the waters of Caribbean and Central American politics in order to exploit difficulties for the United States and to try and cause problems in America's backyard, as it were. And I think that that is a source of problem. The Caribbean, of course, in the late 16th, 17th, 18th, early 19th centuries, saw states that were not centered there, principally Britain, France, and Spain, in part fight it out through protégés and surrogates in the Caribbean. It may be the case that we are moving in that direction, and that could indeed cause problems. It would be linked in some states with poorly developed notions of consultation, accountability in politics. It will be linked to the way in which politics is a racket in some states, with drug money being very important, as we've recently seen in Honduras, for example. It will be linked to the extent to which there is a total political corruption behind the rhetoric in Cuba, and Cuba is the largest of the islands in the Caribbean, and a Cuba that is a cause of instability will be a problem for that area. So I think there are a number of elements one can draw attention to. I hope that people have found this of some interest. They can look at my brief history of the Caribbean to see these substantiated. I don't derive any pleasure from ending on a somewhat pessimistic note. I have to say that I would end pretty well history of anywhere at the moment on a somewhat pessimistic note. So I hope people won't see this as a criticism of the Caribbean, because we are going to soon be moving on to Germany, which, despite its economic circumstances being totally and utterly different, also has some problems that are worth thinking about.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, whose A Brief History of the Caribbean is out now in paperback, for taking us through not just the Caribbean in the 20th century, but in the previous episodes, the centuries before that. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.